Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, entertaining, enlightening, and informative, with tips for creating a healthier state of mind for you, your family, and your friends. So welcome back. I took a little break for a few weeks. I graduated from my Master's of Art in Marriage and Family Therapy on July 22nd, and I needed to take a little breather. So I'm glad to be back. Happy to be in the studio with Jeremy. Awesome to be...
Hello.
Awesome to be back with you. Tonight, we are going to hit up the job market and what's been happening lately and tips for helping you to, hopefully, if you're in the job market, find a job a little bit easier and weather the journey, because it's a little difficult out there, so we want to make it easier for you, okay? My special guest tonight is Dr. Jay Finkelman, and a little bit about Dr. Finkelman. He is currently professor and chair of the Industrial and Business Psychology Department for the Chicago School of Professional Psychology in Los Angeles. He's an industrial and forensic psychologist and an employment and human resources management consultant, and is retained as an expert legal witness. Dr. Finkelman also specializes in sexual harassment, human resource management, workplace investigations, staffing industry management practices, employment discrimination, the Americans with Disabilities Act, compensation practices, independent contractor status, conflict of interest, negligent hiring and retention, wrongful termination, and performance appraisal. Welcome, Dr. Finkelman.
Why, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you, Julianne.
Well, thank you for being here. My first question for you is, how is the job market?
Kind of interesting. The job market is no longer a homogeneous job market. It varies depending on where you are, what types of jobs you're looking for. And I know that you have an audience literally throughout the world. And different countries, different states in the United States all have somewhat different job markets. In general, job growth is slow, but in the positive direction. But that's not the case across the board. So certain segments of the job market seem to be moving along more rapidly than others, and certain parts of the country and the world seem to be experiencing more rapid growth. And obviously, they would be more ideal to be in if you're searching for either first jobs or job changes. So most people overall would think that this continues to be a rough job market, but one in which there are pockets of opportunities, some of which we'll talk about in this program.
Terrific. Could you state maybe where one of those areas are that are having a little more job growth available?
Well, if you look at what people need and where people are spending money or where the government is spending money, that probably isolates the areas of probable job growth. So we know that as the population is aging, healthcare needs are becoming more of an issue, more dominant. More of society's resources are being used to support healthcare services, and that's both medical as well as psychological. So if I were to look at a single generic area that seems to be the one that would benefit by some of the changing and aging demographics, it probably would be the health-related, or as they say, the allied health professions.
So in other words, kind of look for, if you're searching for a job, if you are available to make a move to a different area of the country or the world or whatever, kind of do a little bit of research then on more aging populations. Is that what you're stating?
Well, I think that definitely is a strong predictor of where the jobs will be. Where the population is moving geographically and where the population is moving in terms of age issues, that kind of tells you where people are going to be spending money and where resources are going to be allocated. And that certainly appears to be the case. The cost of medical care across the board, medical and psychological services, is increasing, the implication being that there are more dollars available for people who have the skill sets necessary to get jobs in those domains.
That's interesting. And we're going to hit that up a little bit later, too, because I wanted to, I know we had talked about that previously in our own private conversation. And I'd like to, you know, kind of ask you about how Obamacare is going to be affecting that whole picture. But I want to kind of reel it back here a little bit and ask you who is being affected the most by the recent unemployment.
The recent unemployment is affecting people very differently in different socioeconomic spectrums and across racial categories. So the lower socioeconomic classes are now competing for fewer and fewer jobs as manufacturing in general is going out of, now here I'm talking about the United States, but the flow of manufacturing is to countries that had the cheapest labor. And if you look back over the history of this, a number of decades ago, certain small percentage of U.S. jobs were going to Japan. As Japan got into quality manufacturing and as their costs began rising, Japan, now very similar to the U.S., is losing jobs to countries that were able to do the manufacturing for less and less. So jobs began moving to Korea. Of course, now that's perceived as yet another quality-oriented country where the cost of labor has increased. So they, too, are experiencing an outflow of manufacturing jobs to countries that have lesser and lesser labor costs, whether that's China, which or India, the two giant ones, or somewhat smaller countries like the Philippines and Thailand. That seems to be what's occurring with traditional manufacturing type jobs in the United States and in most countries that are higher up on the totem pole of employee sophistication. In general, we see that the service industry is taking over from the manufacturing industry, and service jobs are very much available in the U.S. And in fact, many countries, whether it's Britain or France, the jobs are in the service industry, but the salaries are extremely low,
right?
Because people going into those job areas are perceived as relatively interchangeable. So certainly those would not be positions to which most people with options would aspire. And instead, they would be looking for increasing skill sets to avoid the literally minimum wage and below that's taking place in the service industry. So those jobs are relatively plentiful. They are high turnover type jobs, and in many instances, they're also high burnout type jobs. Fine for someone out of high school, or fine for someone who is desperate for a small amount of cash, and also fine for people who find it necessary to take second jobs to survive. It is incremental income. But beyond that, it certainly doesn't establish a good career path to be in most service industry jobs.
Right, especially if you're a waiter or waitress. I had a show on a documentary called Where's My Food? And they went through the darker sides of the restaurant business and the low wages and how many hours a lot of the service workers had to work, and it was appalling. You know, I mean, it's below minimum wage because they're relying on tips. Well, you know, people don't tip, then they're, you know, in dire straits.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's a particularly unfortunate industry. There are, I think, substantial violations of wage and hour laws in that industry, and that often goes undetected. the better operations are very careful about that because the penalties, at least in parts of the United States, especially California, are severe. And I've testified in court about wage and hour issues for companies that are doing just what you described. They will get people in saying, look, we have a high turnover. We have some especially more expensive restaurants. We have people who are ordering expensive meals, and therefore the 15 to 20 to 25% tips should be fine, and some of them do, as you noted, try to save some money there, hoping that it will be made up on tips, which is not legal in most of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know over in Europe they just include the tip with it. There's no trying to find out what percentage you're supposed to pay on top of a meal or whatever. It's just incorporated right in. So tipping over there is just looked at like, you know, what are you trying to do here?
That's right. And I think in many ways, since we don't differentiate on tipping based on real service issues for the most part anyway, it's kind of obligatory. I far prefer a system where people are paid properly to begin with. But that's something we can't control, so we don't need to spend more time on that. But I agree with your perspective.
Right, okay. And I want to ask, too, leading into this next question, what is most essential for landing the first job? Because a lot of those service jobs are people's first jobs.
The service jobs are relatively easy to land. It's the old joke that if you're breathing, you'll probably find a service job at some fast food outfit, and that probably is true. And to some degree, if you want to stay out of the food arena, some of those jobs are particularly distasteful. But again, that's making an editorial perspective, which may not be applicable to everyone. But there are also cleaner jobs that are available as first jobs in everything from the Lowe's and the Home Depot and the Walmarts of the world, none of which are known for extravagance in terms of pay, but all of whom try to maintain at least decent working conditions. And if you're dealing with someone who will be ultimately unhappy with the smell of the same food on a daily basis, these may be better options for younger listeners who find that this is an acceptable way to transition into more career-oriented jobs. The kind of an interesting thing there is if you look at many of these chains, whether they're food chains or home supply type chains, you'll also find that they are not limited just to younger people, but many people who have either been laid off from their jobs or who have retired but find the need for extra income are taking jobs there. And the receptivity of employers is greater to older workers than it once was. The law has not changed, but the reality is sometimes different from the law. They kind of recognize that they gain greater stability with an older workforce. So younger people who used to have a slam dunk opportunity to pick up these jobs are now competing with some more seasoned workers in terms of getting them as well. So it's kind of interesting how those demographics have shifted. In terms of the basic hamburger places, of which there are many, they still attract younger workers other than perhaps management, and even management there is much younger. But more people have decided to make careers at some of the big box retailers and the Home Depots of the world, and you do see people staying there longer than they stay at the high turnover food service industries. So there are options even at that end of the spectrum.
So what would you recommend then for people if they're, you know, a little timid and shy and trying to figure out how to get their foot into that first door? What would you recommend that they do first?
I think the first thing to do is to look towards friends and family for any what would be called in the sales business as warm contacts. In other words, a referral by someone who's already working there is a good, comfortable way to be introduced without having to go to human resources and be one of many, 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 many people who are just cold calling and applying. And they'll be taken seriously, but as part of a very large number of people who probably aren't going to get those positions. So to the extent that you have people who are very internet savvy, they will be working their contacts. They will be on Facebook. They will be on all of the, as many of the search engines as they possibly can. They'll be using LinkedIn. They'll be using some of the, what are now considered almost traditional vehicles for learning about opportunity and for getting resumes sent in electronically. The number of people who are sending a paper resume by mail is getting smaller and smaller, and the number of companies and organizations that take that type of job inquiry seriously is becoming smaller and smaller. So the first thing to do is to utilize any contacts that you have. It's also to be carefully searching organizations and companies that you use their products and they have interest in them, and learn about them on the internet. They almost all will have application sites. There really isn't a Fortune 500 company out there where if you go to the internet and you will go to the portion of it which allows you to literally apply online or to search open positions, that's a very comfortable way that doesn't involve going up to a front door asking for human resources and perhaps feeling a bit more intimidated. Having said that, though, people who are confident and people who present a good image are actually better off visiting some of these organizations in person. A good human resource department is likely to want to, if they see someone who looks attractive overall, I'm not talking just about physically attractive, which is not something that should be used legally for selecting applicants, but someone who has poise and confidence and dresses appropriately or slightly above that which would be necessary for the position, nothing wrong with visiting companies, letting them know that you admire them, having done some research so you understand what their needs are and can have a conversation, and simply ask if you can be considered right then and there. Now, some companies with real needs and a proactive human resource management department is going to interview you right then and there, or they'll give you an appointment to come back for an interview. So that's the best of the options for people who have the confidence to do that. The online application, you've got to do a lot of them before something finally clicks. But in a search for the first job, doing everything is the best way to go about it, meaning using any contacts, using any family, using friends who are already working there, doing your internet search. It's fine to also see if there are advertised positions, but that's getting to be less and less significant. Smart and desirable companies, although they sometimes will still use print advertising, that's going out rather rapidly and is not the ideal option. But something else that I think listeners to your show may want to consider is that one of the fastest growing businesses out there is the staffing industry. And you saw my resume. I spent 13 years in the staffing industry, and it has advantages at two levels. First, all they're doing is trying to find people who are willing to go out on jobs. And second, they have to employ a lot of service people as well as salespeople to get business for themselves. So they're a win-win for people looking for jobs. Staffing companies are literally in every part of the world, literally in every state in the United States, and in most cities in the United States, and there's more than one staffing company out there. So whether you're visiting a Manpower or an Adecco or a Robert Half or a Kelly Services, the larger cities in the U.S. have dozens and dozens of staffing companies through offices where the intent is that you walk in and they will interview you and you'll fill out an application. You can also do this online. But if they see someone who they think they can sell to one of their clients, they're not going to let you walk out without making an effort to set up an appointment for you. So to not take advantage of people who will not charge anything to try to get you a job, I think would be foolish. And the staffing services cover all positions from the very menial positions and staffing services that simply do day labor, and there are some giants that do that, to staffing services that specialize in relatively sophisticated positions, whether they're higher-level office service positions or whether they're service into the medical or psychological communities. This can all be determined by quick internet searches, and those visits allow you to talk to a service person, sometimes called a placement coordinator, sometimes a service coordinator, in smaller branches to a branch manager, and just talking about, here are my skill sets, this is my education, this is my training, these are the areas that I'd like to go into, what do you have for me? Now, the sophisticated way to do that is to come in there with some ideas that I'd really like to do something that involves people, I'd like to do something that involves human resources, I'd like to do something in the health service, psychological service arena. That gives them an idea that you're not just out there looking for any job, but that you've at least thought of it. But part of that, and we'll probably talk about this later as well, part of this when you go for an agency-type position is to be flexible for interesting options that you may not thought about, but that they have the need then and there. Because some of the guidelines that I think are applicable for people going for either first jobs or job changes or people who have been laid off or people who have simply been fired is you got to be flexible.
Right.
And you can't assume that you were born in this world to do one job and one job only, because that's a bygone era.
Oh, yeah. Those days are way over.
Exactly.
Yeah, those were probably over at least 10 years ago. Exactly. And I agree. And thank you for those recommendations. Those are great recommendations. And I agree with you with the staffing services. I've used those before in the past, and they're wonderful because the thing is, if you get into an assignment and it's not quite the right fit, you can go back and say, hey, do you have anything else? And there's no hard feelings. You know, it's a wonderful win-win. And plus, a lot of times, a lot of these staffing services will have their own health insurance, even though it's limited, at least it's something. So they run it as their own business, and then they just hire you out. And I've done that several times, and that's a great way to start, you know, gaining contacts. Sometimes if you like the job well enough and they like you, they will make a proposal to hire you. At that point, because that's kind of their way of also testing the waters for employees who are out there and seeing who are good and reliable and seeing who's not going to quite work with, you know, their protocols. So definitely. I would like to reach out to the listeners. If you would like to join us in this conversation with Dr. Jay Finkelman, give us a call at 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And Dr. Finkelman, what is the best strategy for locating the first job?
Well, I think it's pretty much what we've identified in terms of utilizing each and every contact, friend, family member, associate that you know that's in a job that they like and that has enough credibility in the job to want to help you and make an introduction. That's one set of arrangements that I think can't be overlooked. You've mentioned, and you and I totally agree on this, the staffing firms should be utilized They just have an array of positions, and they are willing to talk about people who want to get their first jobs. It's okay to be candid with them. Obviously, they're not going to place you as a chief executive officer in your first job, but they will get first jobs. They will perhaps be lower level than you might otherwise experience. But the other thing, obviously, I have some bias towards the type of career opportunities that schools can offer. And my school, the Chicago School for Professional Psychology, has internships and contacts with many, many organizations that do offer jobs and do offer opportunities. And some are volunteer-based, and some are not. Most are paid positions, and even if they are nonprofit organizations, I think your audience should be aware that nonprofit organizations today are paying very good salaries. They are paying competitive salaries, and as you rise into management ranks at nonprofit organizations, six-figure salaries are relatively routine. So people should not avoid them because of the name nonprofit. And sometimes they would be the ones who would be most receptive and most tolerant for people who have not otherwise been in the job market. And they're always looking for people who might serve. So I really think that that continues to be some combination of internships, family experiences, volunteer work that you may have done, staffing firms, school-related positions. Some schools, as we do at the Chicago School, also have consulting operations internally. In the Los Angeles area, we have an operation called Concise, and that's one that offers opportunities initially to students, and some of those opportunities translate into employment after graduation. The key to a first job is to be flexible and to be receptive to possibilities that you might not have encountered, and not to assume that your education is only going to train you to one particular career or one particular job. That's no longer the case in a world in which, unlike parents and grandparents that would hold jobs for decades and occasionally a lifetime, the turnover rate today is averaging about a job every 2 years.
Wow.
And in certain industries, such as the fast food industry, that goes down to perhaps two jobs a year per person. So things are changing rapidly, and people who are in those markets just have to be, comfortable with the notion of future shock, the Alvin Toffler term from decades back, meaning that things are changing faster each year, and you can't hang on to old approaches or principles or strategies.
Right, and you can't expect too much either. I think, and I've seen this, I have a son who is about 21, and I see what his generation is going through with some of the job difficulties and thinking that they're going to go in there, they're going to be making $15 an hour starting off, and then they find out that it's a lot of the jobs out there are minimum wage, and you have to use it as stepping stones. You can't expect, you know, to earn wages that will get you out of the house and on your own right off the bat. So there has to be a little give and take on, you know, on both the employee and the employer end. But, you know, the expectations, I think, need to be realistic, don't you think?
Yes, very much so. And parents and friends can do a really good job by kind of setting up some of those expectations, namely that a first job in today's environment for someone without a lot of formal education behind them, and in some cases even with formal education, is not going to be sufficient to establish your own household, buy your own car, and begin taking exotic vacations. And more people are learning that they may have to live with parents or with friends for longer than they would otherwise have anticipated, simply because the market requires them to gain the experience and begin to develop some kind of a nest egg so they can begin making investments both in their home and in their future. And the issue of healthcare is really something that especially younger people in the job market aren't always paying attention to. And you pointed out correctly that the smarter staffing firms are making healthcare available at a cost. It's rarely free or as inexpensive as it would be for full-time positions with large employers, but it is something to consider to begin protecting yourself against catastrophic events that you don't really want to think about. To the extent that you can remain on parents' health plans, especially until we determine what Obamacare is really going to provide, that's not a bad strategy. It allows you to save money as long as you can, and there are provisions to permit that for longer and longer as it's becoming increasingly difficult for many people to get their own health care, although that could change, and we should have more information very shortly about that.
Right, although it was... Now, it's slated to go in 2015 from the latest that I heard, so...
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, okay.
My understanding as well.
Yeah, and then also, you know, the 20-somethings on their parents' insurance, is that still until about age 26 also?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I don't think that will change, but there are so many movements taking place to change things, although most of those movements do not appear to be even remotely realistic about what is necessary to repeal things like Obamacare. So I would say, even though the finances are not certain at the moment, the likelihood of some of those provisions that I think are really pretty key for many people in the population, I think you can kind of count on their being there, including the ability to stay on parental health plans for longer than would otherwise have been the case.
Right. And just a quick question on this, and then I'm going to repeat the phone number again. With the Obamacare, when it finally gets into the at a point where it's going to go into place, would you predict that employment will start opening up at that point? Because it seems like employers are almost paranoid to hire people at this point because they don't know what's happening with the Obamacare situation and whether they are going to be responsible for the health care of their employees and how much they're going to be, liable for.
That's an insightful question, and the general answer is yes. What's happening now is that people are waiting. They are trying to restrict hours below 30 on a weekly basis. They're trying to do things that don't trigger provisions of Obamacare. At a certain point, that will either be unnecessary or just too impractical. But what you're observing is occurring, and it's unfortunate. But it's one of the reasons that I'm suggesting the utility of remaining on parental plans as long as possible.
Right.
But I think that will get better. The economics of Obamacare are still difficult because you're covering so many more million employees, and there is a cost. The other side of that, and I don't have the answer in that, and I'm hoping people in the finance and political communities are working on that. I'm sure they are. But the other implication is that the prediction that I shared with our audience at the beginning of your program, that the job opportunities in the health and related disciplines, including psychological services, should increase because so many more people are going to be both requiring the services and those services are also going to be covered. So it would appear that the opportunity will present itself, and I'm not sure exactly whether the wage rates that we're currently seeing in health-related disciplines, which seem to be outpacing inflation, I don't know if regulations will put some brakes on that. Perhaps they need to, but I do know that that growth is inexorable. It must continue as the population requires these services, ages, mm-hmm. and grows. So that kind of gives you the that telegraphs where jobs are likely to move.
Right, and I also heard the prediction that, you know, once 2015 hits, there's actually going to be a shortage of people in the medical and psychological fields. They're going to need more people. They're going to be in demand then. So, if you have any inclination out there as a listener to go towards either one of those fields, I would highly recommend it. And there is a lot of programs out there. So, yeah, if you want to gear up, I mean, the funding is out there now, which is great, and the student loans are opening up. They decided, thankfully, to not increase the student loan percentage because they were going to double the payback rate, which would have put it in about 13% payback for the loans. And, yeah, that can get pretty pricey after a while. So luckily that was put into place about 2-3 months ago. So, if you can, do the schooling, do the work and move forward, because that is probably the number one situation, is to go and get schooling no matter what you're passionate about. But that's it. Go find what you're passionate about so that you have the energy to get through the whole program and get to a better site and get better paying jobs and be happy with your life and the work situation, because we're spending so many hours working now. It's, hard to do work that you really hate. It's very draining. Been there, done that, so I don't want to go back there.
Yeah, no, you're giving, I think you're giving very good advice, Julianne.
Thank you.
The best investment that people can make is with respect to their education. The statistics are absolutely crystal clear on this in terms of the differential of what people earn in their lifetime as they go from a high school degree to a college degree to a master's degree and to a doctoral degree for those who are capable of doing it. They're just dramatic. And yes, it's true that you take on additional debt as you do this and that you are out of the labor force for additional years as you do it, but it pays back in multiples. And
truly,
very easy to review those statistics. They are on the internet. They are reasonably accurate from what I can see, and it is the best investment that you can make. What's interesting is that it no longer is an all-or-none situation where you simply have to either make a decision, I'm going to go to school, or I'm going to work. An increasing percentage of students at the Chicago school, and I suspect that most other schools that are professional service oriented are working at the same time.
Right, I did so.
I certainly did when I went through an MBA degree and a doctoral degree, and people are doing it even more now. And more schools are accommodating and flexible, recognizing that students do have monetary needs and do have to work, and there's nothing that precludes doing both. You will have to work hard, and you lose some free time, but it's just a great investment, and it's the right thing to do for all the reasons we're describing.
Right. I highly, highly agree. I just want to mention to the listeners, if for some reason you are not able to hear this whole podcast and you would like to go back and hear it again or play it for your family or friends, you can go to iTunes Store and you can download this program at Psych 1-on-1, and that's PSYCH, the number 1. ON and another number 1. We are also on Stitcher and Facebook. So you can download us at any time. You can come back to the homepage, and there are about 20 shows of Psych 101 right now. So go back. We've got some pretty interesting topics, and we always like to hear what you have to say about it. So, and the next question I'd like to ask is, since we're kind of dancing around this issue, what are the challenges of changing careers?
Well, changing careers is a challenge, but it is taking place more and more frequently. So it used to be people would change careers when they got fired or something horrible happened. And as I indicated, people are changing jobs depending on which parts of the country or which countries in the world and which industries. But the typical graduate is changing jobs at least initially every 2 years, if not more frequently. So career changes are very much part of what people do, and there is a serendipitous element to it in that people are not born to be, no matter what your parents have told you, a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, or whatever. People actually evolve and do change careers a number of times, as I have and as many in our audience have probably started to do as well.
Yeah, I'm on my fifth career right now, so yeah.
Hey, very much illustrating the point. So the good part of that is that you have all of the excitement of learning about new businesses, new organizations, new industries. And for people who tend to get bored or people who may be burnt out, it's not that they're burnt out in working, but they may be burnt out in just pursuing something that they already know, that they're already familiar with, and that this kind of a change charges them up with totally different perspectives, levels of engagement that otherwise would not be there. Now, on the other side, it means that you've got to be willing to learn a new business, a new industry. It may mean that you need to step down a notch from what you had been doing and prove yourself once again to new bosses who you may not have insight about going in, although you certainly would want to find out everything you possibly could. And you have to learn and deal with new political structures. And many people in organizations today find that the greatest challenge is not doing the job or learning the job, but it's dealing with the politics of the organization.
Right.
Some people change careers specifically because they get disgusted with the politics of what they're seeing and just decide that they want to go into a new business entirely. But to ignore the political realities of a business, an organization, or an industry you elect to go into can be very dangerous. So you need to do whatever is possible to learn about it going in and simply to be ready to deal with it and understand that there are many things that are hidden when you're first interviewing for a job or when you're first solicited for a job that won't be obvious to you until you're actually working in a job. But having said that, it still can be a very exciting point for most people, even more so than simply changing from one employer to another. People tend to like to develop, or at least capable people tend to like to develop new skills, and they like the new challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So recognizing that you need to perhaps hustle a little bit more to both prove yourself again to new bosses, changing careers is an option. And it also ties back to the need for the kind of eclectic training that doesn't just get you ready for one particular job in one particular career, but could actually generalize across a number of jobs in some of the growing disciplines that we've discussed.
Mm-hmm. You have well-rounded skills, in other words, and that's what they're looking for, because every job application that I have filled out recently, and I have filled out recently because I just got fired from my job about 2-3 weeks ago, so I'm back on the market again. Every one of them, what skill sets did you bring to this? What improvements did you make to this company? So, you know, just to be able to write that down on a piece of paper and figure out, what did I do at my last jobs? What did I bring to the table? I think that's really helpful to just sit down and realistically look at that within yourself, to be able to put that out in writing on those applications, and to be able to speak about that during job interviews is really helpful.
And Julianne, you're right on target in this. I'm sorry that you did have that experience with respect to loss of a job.
Thank you.
But the good news for you and for others is that that is no longer the stigma that it once was, where being fired from a job or terminated or laid off used to be personalized to the point that obviously this is a person who can't be any good, or why would this have happened. This has become so routine now that it simply is not something that would eliminate you from consideration anywhere, and it's considered part of just job experiences. And smart employers recognize that not only does this happen, but it actually makes for stronger people, more well-rounded people, as you were noting, Julianne, more well-rounded people because of the diversity of their background. And is something that should be stated, I think, very candidly. Now, obviously, if you've been terminated for cause because you've picked a fight with someone or you've stolen things,
right,
that doesn't have the positive connotation,
right,
that someone who has been terminated because a job has been eliminated or a company has downsized, one is perfectly acceptable and should be disclosed very candidly. The other is a different kind of a problem.
Right. And Dr. Finkelman, as we're wrapping up, I've got two more questions to ask you, okay?
Sure.
Okay, the first one is, what are the hot areas to pursue right now?
Well, I think we've kind of pre-identified them when we're talking about health and psychological services. The allied medical areas are the ones that clearly are expanding, and we all know that the needs are so great out there, and to the extent that support is provided that allow people, we've always known about the medical needs. That's not been a secret, and how difficult it is to get medical services, even in a country as great as ours. But the psychological needs at many levels, whether it's at the marriage and family counseling level, the school counseling level, many different levels, we always understood that those issues and needs were out there, but they were rarely supported or covered. There's now the beginnings of a very, I think, hopeful future in which it's recognized that these are as important as the traditional medical needs, and they are critical to an increasing array of people in our population, with one of the biggest being the veterans. And the amount of psychological disability of people returning from combat and the post-traumatic stress disorders are affecting a frightening percentage of troops and returning vets. The suicide rate is unconscionably high.
Yes.
Just illustrating that the need for the kind of services that can be offered by the medical and psychological communities is great, and I continue to believe that these are hot areas. The other is the one that we spoke about earlier. I think the nonprofit segment is growing rapidly and should be taken very seriously and not assumed to be non-payment. You and I discussed this briefly in an earlier phone call, Julianne. Nonprofit does not mean non-paying, And in addition, the number of family businesses that are being started predominantly by entrepreneurial individuals who will need many outsiders, and working in family businesses can be challenging and demanding, but they're growing rapidly, and they're a good area of opportunity for people who have the resources and the inclination to be entrepreneurial but not to start their own thing. There are some very good franchise opportunities out there, and they should be considered as well and carefully reviewed and evaluated before putting money down and making the plunge. But these are all areas that I'm anticipating significant growth going forward.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you for those tips. And the last thing I'd like to ask is, can you tell our listeners about some of the techniques that they can use to keep a positive outlook when they're job hunting?
Yes, and this is an important one. If you have been job hunting for a while, and we see the television coverage of people who have been out there sometimes for years, but often for months, because it takes months to get jobs, and it could be longer depending on the level of the job and your experience. If your approach to a prospective employer is, I'm really beaten down, and I'm tired, and I'm desperate, and I'm coming here, but I don't think that I'm going to get much from you, that kind of a message becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy, and you can be absolutely certain that you're not going to be hired. So you have to approach every interview fresh and enthusiastic, and as though it's the only interview that you're ever going to have, and you're going to put all your effort into showing how excited you are about a job opportunity. You would want to, as I've indicated, perhaps visit in person initially companies that you admire, and you'd want to get full information about the company so you can have a credible conversation and not asking silly disqualifying questions. How many employees do you have? What do you do? Where are your other branches or offices located? Most employers and people who do the interviewing as part of human resources know that a motivated prospect is going to know all of that and is going to do the research.
Right.
So while it's good to come in with some canned questions of some insightful thoughts that you have that you pose in the form of a question about the requirements of the job and the organization, make sure you're not asking things that you should have determined on your own. And the last areas are to ask for help from anyone that you know, whether it's on the internet, whether you're just posting it as part of your Facebook interchanges or LinkedIn or whoever you know who you can help you. There's nothing to be ashamed about by recognizing that people are both out there who can be useful to you, and most people like to help if they're asked.
Yes.
So I think that's the series of tips that can keep you fresh and exciting for prospective employers.
Thank you. That is some really, really wonderful recommendations, Dr. Finkelman. And if anybody would like to contact you, how can they do so?
They can certainly contact me through my office at the Chicago School for Professional Psychology, and I believe I gave you the phone number or the email for the industrial organization and business departments, and that's probably the best bet to use.
Okay, and also if anybody would like to contact me personally, my email is jgoode8@verizon.net. Again, that's jgoode8@verizon.net. If you'd like to email any questions or comments, that would be a great way to do it. Dr. Finkelman?
Yeah, you can pass along to me anything that you think I can be helpful on. I'm delighted to do that. And the Chicago School also has a website. I'm located at our downtown LA office. So lots of different ways to find us.
Wonderful. And thank you so much, Dr. J. Finkelman. It was very interesting, very helpful, and a wonderful conversation. So
my pleasure to chat with you as well. Thank you for asking me.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in and for staying with us. And hopefully we're going to be changing format a little bit up the road here. We're going to be freshening things up and hopefully gain some more exciting speakers in, like Dr. Finkelman. And stay tuned for the Qumran Reports on Right After Me. Special thanks to Jeremy and Nick for keeping free speech alive at Skid Row Studios. And this is Julianne Good. This is Psych 101. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.